This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of The Poetics of Sleep, the first installment of Cabinet's Bunk Bed Conversation series, featuring poets Jeff Dolvin and Wayne Kostenbaum. It took place on March 25th, 2010.
Leaves the insect's tunnel. We must go under the wallpaper to meet the insect gladiator, to battle with a net and trident, and leave the fountain and the square.
Oh,
that we could sleep up there.
So why does she want to sleep up there?
I know it. I think it's this pure dreamscape, right? It's got none of the clutter of the floor, none of the clutter of the world that we, you know, bang our shins against. You have this picture of the ceiling where the chandelier juts up like a fountain, and you could imagine yourself sort of moving into sleep and moving into dream as though it were a completely clean place, quiet, orderly, like a hospital ward without the sickness, something like that.
Huh. So does this have to do with her mother's institutionalization?
Oh. I don't know.
Seriously.
Yeah.
I don't know. It is so peaceful on the ceiling. It is the back ward. You know, the little crystal lithium dispenser. It's all the bidet is in the dark.
Well, it's definitely the case that it doesn't, you know, that it doesn't stay as placid as it starts. So the wallpaper is peeling. You can't help but think about what's below or what's above, and you can't quite keep below and above straight. So the wallpaper is peeling, and you start to populate the walls around with animals. And what really, where the poem really starts to get weird for me is this: the foliage rustles under the leaves, the insect's tunnel. And then, you know, you've got some, all of that safety, cleanness, levelness, plainness of that first dreamscape, yikes, it's got creatures crawling around underneath.
Huh, like Rousseau, the painter.
Oh, yeah.
Not the, whatever his other
poems were. Right. Well, like it's the, kind of a state of nature.
Doesn't the mighty flowers remind you of Wordsworth's and, oh, that mighty heart is lying still or something? Do you think she stole it? You know what I mean? Doesn't the mighty seem like it's come from another poem? I guess somebody doesn't want us to even be thinking about that poem anymore. Because here's, well, I'm not supposed to see it up there to create dramatic realism, but I'm reading something. I'm actually reading a poem kind of down here, too, and it's by Wordsworth. We could make, maybe a smoother way to make that transition would be to think a little bit about unconsciousness and the state before life. Because Wordsworth is talking here about the state, the entire forgetfulness that we leave to become awake beings. I don't know, do you want to read this? It's closer to you.
How do you mean that, Wayne? Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting, and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our home.
Hey, can I interrupt you just for a second?
Yeah. Hey,
okay, do you have an image for what that trailing clouds of glory looks like? Honestly? What do you picture when you hear trailing clouds of glory?
Trailing clouds of glory. I see, and this is probably easier to picture in the top bunk than in the bottom bunk. I see those vapor trails across the sky, slowly spreading and dispersed. What's the unlimning? How does Hamlet say it? The clouds that rack and dislimn or unlimn or something like that. But they also seem to me like they could be the opposite of those tenacious, burrowing insect tracts that we just got in the Bishop poem. Because when I think of the Bishop, I think of the way in which the imagination, as you start to let go of it, won't quite stay in that plain crystalline space.
but starts to fall captive to the kind of burrowing of bad dream, of obsession. And I think in a lot of the poems about sleep that I've been reading recently, there is this sort of funny problem of losing control of your imagination and it getting the better, either getting into sleep or getting the better of sleep or something like that.
Do you think, I always think that the stanzas in that ode which sort of pulse outward and swell, but then get contained because a section of the poem ends and a new one begins. I always get the sense that, I kind of lost my train of thought. It had something to do with how one, I think it's kind of fun to just see you for a second.
You can come up if you like.
Later. You said drowned in the imagination. Yeah, that Wordsworth doesn't get overwhelmed by his imagination because he can end one of these little orgasmic stanzas. They puff out and then they stop and then he moves on. And that the lines do that too. Mm-hmm. But I want to still worry the line, trailing clouds of glory. Because here's my question. If you trail a cloud of glory, can you take credit for it? Or is it, just, can I tell you my image now?
Well, yeah.
There's actually a really famous pianist named Jeffrey Kahane. He's actually playing with the New York Philharmonic this weekend. And about 35 years ago, I heard a story that when he was at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, he left the bathroom there was like toilet paper trailing from his pants. And so I think of that kind of shame with the trailing of the clouds of glory. Do you come from that? Who's there? But seriously, I also wonder if the clouds of glory that drift behind you are something that you can take credit for, or whether it's the detritus that you're leaving behind.
Yeah, right. Or whether you can only take sad credit for the motion that separates you from them, or something like that.
Sad credit. Sad credit makes me want to join you in your bunk. But have I introduced you to Elizabeth Bishop?
Hey, absolutely. I've been waiting to meet her for years.
Yes.
Is there, you know, your image of the toilet paper trailing, you know, that sort of cloud of, is there something embarrassing about sleep? I remember reading some, you know, it's in a book about Keats, maybe Christopher Ricks, the Keats and Embarrassment book, quotes a line from Havelock Ellis. There's something, there's always something embarrassing about eating,
right,
which is
right.
A killer.
Right.
And I wonder if that's true of sleeping as well.
The fact is that when people sleep, they make strange noises. And I'm thinking actually back to Elizabeth, that's not Elizabeth Bishop. Elizabeth Bishop.
Are you dreaming of him or am I?
No, that's both of us.
Both
I instigated
wow.
them. But Elizabeth Bishop must have had stertorous breathing because of her drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sleeps on the top of a mast with his eyes fast closed. The sails fall away below him like the sheets of his bed, leaving out in the air of the night the sleeper's head. Leaving out in the air of the night is a trailed cloud of glory.
Mm-hmm.
Asleep he was transported there, asleep he curled in a gilded ball on the mast's top, or climbed inside a gilded bird, or blindly seated himself astride. The sleeper seems punished. I mean, in terms of the Keats and embarrassment, but he sleeps on the top of his mast like a kind of punished exile with his eyes closed tight, little shame baby. The gull inquired into his dream, which was, I must not fall. The spangled sea below wants me to fall. It is hard as diamonds, it wants to destroy us all. Seems like the weird, queer kid reject that he sleeps on the top of a mast. And then
yeah.
It has to do with sleep, but it does. Isn't there a story about a little boy who gets eaten by all the other people on a boat?
I don't know. But it sounds like a story to have nightmares about. And to protect yourself against, that is, this feels like, you know, if I could put myself at the greatest remove, curl myself in that ball, that would be a sleep that nobody would know about, nobody could see. Because that's one of the, you know, sleeping It's not sleeping that's shameful. It's being seen sleeping, mm-hmm. being heard sleeping, snoring,
right.
Or like Noah, you know, mm-hmm. naked in his tent, come upon right. by his sons
right.
while he's sleeping.
Huh. That's a very important moment, actually, in yeah. the history of nudity and the history of fathers. It is. I'm glad that you brought it up.
Yeah.
Actually. But I had a... Go on.
Because that's weird, isn't yeah. it? Like, fathers yeah. sleeping is yeah. powerful stuff.
Yeah. And Freud had the dream about... Freud had the dream about the... It's not Freud's dream, but a burn... There's a dead child, and the father has the dream in the next room that the kid's saying, "Help me, Father, I'm burning. Don't you see, Father, that I'm burning?" These are just things that don't necessarily go anywhere.
Yeah.
But
well, precisely.
The other thing about poetry, though, neither Elizabeth Bishop nor Wordsworth were asleep when they wrote those poems. They were not even... No, but it's true. And nor were they even in the Kubla Khan state of having just received a celestial visitation. Mm-hmm. They were wide awake, crafting, scheming, organizing, persona building, but he sleeps on the top of a mast. It's not the floods of the unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think, can you think of a poet who does seem to compose in that crepuscular?
Alice Notley, mm-hmm. She has an epic, she wrote about 10, 15 years ago, The Descent of Alette, and it's all dreams. And they seem to be written in this shamanistic trance that she's been infused by these voices. And I think having heard her read from them and discuss them, that she actually, she kind of closed her eyes and seemed to be rocking back and forth a little bit. I think that that's a direct, that's a transmission literature. And I'm not saying it's better than another kind of non-transmitted literature, but it is, since we're talking about sleep and poetry, and it is interesting to note the tightness of the enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there is also the irregular line lengths, which...
Yeah, it makes me think a couple of things. Yeah. One, tightness of enclosure, because that's such a sterile one, but also there's the sort of world of sleep bower. I'd love to talk about that.
Let's
but
do sleep
also
bower.
Also the rocking.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And just that sense of, of one kind of affinity. I can't stop thinking about him.
We're going to explain who he is in a minute.
The sort of regularity of rhythm that descends upon us in sleep when the voluntary muscles are disabled, those kind of hectic and toretic muscles that we use to get us through the day, and we're left with the iambic muscles that get us through
the deeper breathing,
the night.
Hmm.
Yeah, and that some, or at least there's something about poetry that wants to resolve to that mere rhythm.
Huh.
If sort of prose is action, then there's an element of poetry that is sinking into sleep.
So it's like the rapturous, Freud talks about rapturous thumb sucking. And you know, it's kind of like rocking.
Mm.
So that's iambic, and that's as opposed to the toretic, involved, diurnal, there's the kind of measured trance state of a certain kind of poem that has a contract with a reader that says, "I will mesmerize you.
Yes.
You may suck my thumb, I will suck your thumb. We will be in this tight dyad of suckling and enclosure at some cost."
Yes. Absolutely.
I don't know what the cost
and that's,
is.
Well, there's something shameful about poetry, too, right?
Yeah.
Just the whole business is a little sketchy.
No,
I've never done that with anyone, like some thumb, the thumb sucking exchange thing.
No, no,
I'm
no,
not
no,
proposing.
No. You have a cold. Just,
yeah.
Yeah. But so, for a fee, we'll suck audience thumb.
afterwards. Sarah Sakai, yes, very good.
Who is this, by the way, behind us? Is she a hysteric? She seems like a hysteric.
Perhaps.
She seems really calm.
She seems pretty, I mean, she seems like, it seems like one of those Charcot photographs of a woman in some stage of a fit, but she could be dead.
Well, maybe she gets us into the bower, because okay, these bowers are troubled by the murmuring of innumerable bees,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
This kind of, so I'm thinking she's got kind of a net to protect her.
Exactly, from the insects and
the
wallpaper.
And the bower.
So let's do a bower. Bower, when we were talking about sleep last night, sleep and poetry last night here, we talked about bower consciousness as a really, we talked about bower consciousness as a really important part of the marriage of sleep and poetry, and we both got very excited thinking about the bower that at least English language poetry for 500 years has constructed intertextually to create this charmed space of sleep and lull and narcotic drowsy syrups.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Where do you want to lead us?
Let's listen to a little Keats.
Okay.
Shall we?
Okay.
The Keats Nightingale Ode.
I need to go downstairs to hear it.
Okay.
Better. But wait.
Do you want to read it?
No. Wait. Detaching.
All right. I cannot see what flowers are at my feet, nor what soft incense hangs upon the boughs, but in embalmed darkness guess each sweet wherewith the seasonable month endows the grass, the thicket, and the fruit tree wild, white hawthorn and the pastoral eglantine, fast-fading violets covered up in leaves, and mid-May's eldest child, the coming musk-rose full of dewy wine, the murmurous haunt of flies on summer eves. Mm. Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death, called him soft names in many a mused rhyme to take into the air my quiet breath. Now more than ever seems it rich to die, to cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain, to thy high requiem become a sod.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I have a friend, who thinks that sod, can I climb up again?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that okay?
Sorry.
Who thinks that sod rhyme is a joke. I think it's amazing. Sod, like, to thy high requiem become a sod.
Yeah.
And thinks that the sod is a bad word choice. What do you think?
No, I think I'm with you. That is, that line just sort of dies into earth at its close. There's no, all of the echo, you know, it's as though a sort of resonant room, as though you're suddenly buried in earth or swathed in felt or something, yeah, like that, and all the echo goes dead.
So in terms of the rapturous thumb-sucking paradigm, but also the bower, is the sod state akin to the embowered, lulled by drowsy syrup state? Or is it post-lull catatonia?
Yeah. It feels like it's the finish of, it's, yeah, a sort of decrescendo, that there is something about this bower space where, I don't know. It's there's a lot of smell,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
which is a sense that you can fall asleep to.
Yeah.
You can't imagine, or it would be very rare to be awakened by a smell in a way that you could be awakened by a sound. So the sort of perfume and drowsiness, and I think almost composting of some of these bower spaces. Mm-hmm. That is, there's something a little fetid there. And it's as though, you know, the imagination needs to rot, mm-hmm, to make, and then finally where we end up is humus, soil.
So why are these fragrant, humid, sexual, rank, dark boxes, these enclosures, powerful for poets to describe? I mean, they obviously, the way Keats gets off there when he, I cannot see what flowers at my feet, but in embalmed darkness, he gets excited, guess each sweet wherewith, and then he goes into, it's almost like a set piece, but it's fast fading violets covered up in leaves, it's happening in real time in that line, but the point is, there's a kind of pornographic hyper-saturation of sense information rendered through vowels and consonants there. Why? Like, why do that? It's obviously, there's a drive toward that.
Yeah.
And that's the drive for Bauer consciousness.
Yeah.
But it's a specific poet's hobby. It's like they return to this little space. I'm going to write a Bauer passage. It's going to be filled with smells and labials and, you know,
yeah.
And murmurous haunt of flies on summer eves. It's obviously, it's like wanting to kiss Shakespeare or something.
Right.
Yeah. But, so what do you think?
Bauer.
Yeah. I think, you know, and then the kind of synesthesia, right, that Norwood soft incense hangs upon the boughs. Why is this poetry? Well, if you think of poetry making as as not only a kind of synthetic faculty, but as somehow dissolving all sorts of boundaries that ordinarily ought to be maintained between things. You know, it just makes me think Freud, to go back to Freud, that his distinction between primary and secondary process thinking, the kind of organized, categorical, rational thinking that gets us through the day, and that structures our utterances in prose, those that we use to affect action. Poetry needs somehow to make those boundaries more porous and seep across them. And if those honeycomb cells start to be so suffused with the honey they contain that they break down, then a poem maybe starts to happen, something like that.
Right. Because it's certainly, you're right, it's not death wish. I mean, it'd be very easy to look at this and say, well, the wish to fall asleep is just a wish to die. And he even says, I have been half in love with easeful death. And that may have been true, but what's more palpable is how he wants to immerse himself in a liminal state that we could call the poetry sleep state, that's conjuring through sound a very specific imaginative space that is a bower, and it has its own menu and dramatis personae. I feel like this leads us backward to Spencer, but we don't have to go there. But
Milton before Spencer.
So, we're in a garden. Okay, so I think maybe we need to go to Milton.
You want to?
That's not Milton. Okay. Should I read it to you?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
I love it when you read to me.
Okay. Thus talking hand in hand, alone they passed onto their blissful bower. It was a place chosen by the sovereign planter when he framed all things to man's delightful use. The roof of thickest covert was in woven shade, laurel and myrtle, and what higher grew of firm and fragrant leaf. On either side, acanthus and each odorous bushy shrub fenced up the verdant wall. Each beauteous flower, iris all hues, roses and jessamine, reared high their flourished heads between and wrought mosaic. That is really intense. And wrought is a verb there. So, and wrought. What did you do today? I wrought mosaic. And the line break, and wrought. You know, I guess it is also kind of Moses in there. Mosaic. Underfoot, the violet, crocus, and hyacinth with rich inlay broidered the ground, more colored than with stone of costliest emblem. Other creature here, bird, beast, bird, insect, or worm, durst enter none. Such was their awe of man. Okay, so why are we so excited by the best part is obviously, I think, reared high their flourished heads between and wrought mosaic.
And it's a killer enjambment, isn't it?
Yeah.
And wrought mosaic. I look at this and it's so surprising that it It is this Bauer space, but it's sort of flirting with architecture, isn't it? As though the floor might be stony and then broidered back to fabric, and then we return to this natural world where the beast, bird, and insect and worm are around. And there, parenthetically, there are dream botherers again, right? Mm-hmm. These little creatures that keep coming back, keep working their way into sleep. But I feel with Milton both the protection, and maybe that relation to shame again, the sense that this is what we do in here cannot be seen, inwoven shade, thickest covert.
Right.
This is a covert operation we've got here, a most deliquescent variety. But also, there's something, you know, Milton can't quite go as far as Keats goes. He's something a little churchy about the space.
Deep too. Church,
What was it about the mosaic that...
It's just such a vigorous, he's so proud when he says that. Even though it's the iris, all the plants are doing it, it's his phallic advancement there. Reared high, their flourished heads between, it's obviously Satan, but it's reared high, their flourished heads between, because it's a serpent and wrought mosaic. Obviously this passage is a mosaic, and he's bragging about his tapestry, but it's the garden, it's the blissful Bower that's intrinsically the evil Eve serpent female space that's going to make mankind fall. So that's the cost for him, the theological cost, as you enter the Bower and mankind falls. I don't know. I mean, just experientially, I don't care. I don't think sleep is like a Bower. I think states of being mesmerized and entranced by art are Bowers. Mm-hmm. And so auto-hypnosis is a Bower, and maybe he's proposing that a kind of auto-hypnosis in the face of a work of art, this beguiled state, is what he's going to call sleep. You know what I mean? I mean, sleep is actually, what is sleep like? It's like being on the subway. It's not a Bower.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to agree.
Because it's one of the things that's sort of hard about thinking about sleep and poetry is that there is the you think a lot about where you sleep, about getting in and out of sleep, about that sort of crepuscular middle, but sleep itself, what is that? You know, is it just a sod? You know, is it when it gets, you know, when Keats gets to sleep,
right?
He has only that word left, and
then,
you know, the echo dies.
I think. Do you ever wake up? I mean, what is your? This is now not Milton Keats. This is Jeff. So, do you wake up at night with language? What is the relationship between sleep and a kind of language that you think of as lyric or ecstatic or held apart from ordinary language use? Like, are there words in your dreams? Or is sleep just? What's the relation between language and sleep for you?
Music is more part of, especially the transition for me, and the dream that I can think musically. So that has something to do with poiesis, I think. But as though, you know, on a double bass, I can work out the day's problems. It's a kind of ecstatic. Sometimes enough to wake me up again. Sometimes I'll remember a word. I remember a dream. I was talking to you that this is sort of all coming back, sleep and poetry, and my dissertation advisor.
Oh yeah,
I had this series of dreams about John Hollander, who was an extremely distinguished person. Got deep inside my head, and one of these dreams. Yes. Maybe I shouldn't.
No, yeah. No, I'm just trying to. I'm trying to just give space here in the bed for this memory.
Yeah.
It's gonna need a lot of air. Yeah.
But as it's a triptych of dreams, I probably shouldn't unfold all of them, although they well up. But one of them is about encountering him in a sort of auditorium space. There is a small creature, a chipmunk, but somehow more beguiling still than a chipmunk, and it's moving to the edge of the tiers of the stadium, and so it's in some peril. And he sees this out of the corner of his eyes, and I, you know, really with a grace that I've never possessed in actual life, I sort of bicycle kick this little fellow back to safety. And Hollander looks at me, and he nods, and he says, "You must know Husi, who himself knows the city very well."
That's and it great. Felt. Who's Husi?
Husi, I don't know.
Husi. How do you spell
that's
Husi?
The, that word, though.
But how would you spell? Like H-U-S-S-I?
I think it was H-O-O-S-E-Y.
Husi.
Yeah. Husi. But that felt like the most, you know, lavish. I felt, oh, I have, you know, there's hope for me.
Husi.
Husi, who knows the city very well.
Husi, who knows the city. Say the line again, because it is a line.
You must know Husi, who himself knows the city very well.
You must know Husi, who himself knows the city very well. The last, it's 15 syllables.
Mm-hmm.
You must know Husi, line break, who, I can't remember now, who knows the city well. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just, so what... I don't know where to go with that.
I don't either.
No, but
for
I'm
years,
very gratified that you brought us that dream.
But it does. Mm-hmm. It was a sound as much as anything. A sense that I was given that word as a word that sort of lodged and stuck with me.
I often have dreams where I'm writing in an either invisible ink, often on my bed sheets or something, or and I'm writing and it's. And there's a terror in the dream that it's fading. I mean, that I wake, I think, okay, and it's usually if there's something I'm working on in the day, that at night I'm writing it and there's something really wonderful feeling about it, and I'm writing it, or the idea is fugitive and I'm barely getting it down, and I'm writing it, and then I realize that I'm only writing it with my finger and there's no ink. it's such a recurrent dream of, you know, inscription that becomes inscrutable immediately. And you always wake up with a little bit of a sense of having been vanquished or having lost something.
Do you ever harvest any language from those dreams?
I don't think I wonder if I've ever harvested. People say funny things in my dream. People are really mean and witty. And I like it. I mean, when I can't think of anything offhand except for something that years ago Jackie Onassis said to me in a dream, or about me. She said, "You never know when Wayne's going to tell a dirty joke." That kind of thing.
I wonder if these dreams and their fading, you know, that if there isn't, if we don't want so much to think of sleep as poiesis, and it, you know, and it ain't.
Right.
That is, it's such a powerful analogy or, you know, metaphor for creation. But these dreams don't bring us, don't make for us. You know, in the way that you were saying earlier, we have to get up and perhaps even have a cup of coffee and write.
The poetry of dreams is Husi. Where Husi leads, Husi is the foundation stone of the poem. Literally, it is, because it's a hieroglyph. It's obviously a switch point of several linguistic and emotional channels, and it's you know, it's like a little Sappho nugget.
Uh-huh.
It's buried there. I wonder if we could think about Proust, because we're talking about poetry, but we're really also things that happen to be in poems. That's John Giorno, one of Warhol's boyfriends from the 60s. Duh. And he's the star of a movie, Sleep. So this is the beginning of Proust, and it's prose, but he does things with the sleep state that may be more in tune with our own experience than the Bauer states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like somebody from the audience should read it. Alan, do you want to read it?
Sure.
Is that too cruel? No, okay.
For a long time, I used to go to bed early. Sometimes when I put out my candle, my eyes would close so quickly that I had not even time to say to myself, I'm falling asleep. And half an hour later, the thought that it was time to go to sleep would awaken me. I would make as if to put away the book, which I imagine was still in my hands, and to blow out the light. I had gone on thinking, while I was asleep, about what I had just been reading, but these thoughts had taken a rather peculiar turn. It seemed to me that I myself was the immediate subject of my book, a church, a quartet, the rivalry between Francois the First and Charles the Fifth.
That's nice, even without a microphone. Thank you. That's really great. So, falling asleep reading, do you drop the book when you read? Do you read in bed?
I read in bed. I once dropped a book reading in the bath, fell asleep, and it became an... I did write a poem about that. It was a Machiavelli, actually. Reading Machiavelli in the bath?
What were you planning?
Exactly. But it became such an amazing. It's pulp. Strove to return to some origin. It just became this amazing flower.
So you fell asleep reading Machiavelli in the bath.
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
Right.
Was it for an assignment?
I think I was teaching it at some point, and I was sort of desperate to make of this because I love when I read. I love to enjoy myself.
Right.
And this was, I was having a hard time, I think, with that. So I thought, I'll take a bath. And so I brought Niccolo with me. The frame narrative is peculiar, is that sense that this book itself sort of wonderfully dissolved. That is, afterwards, it became such a charismatic object and a kind of, maybe a little bit of a figure for sort of what happens to the mind in relation to a book in falling asleep, that it becomes much less organized, much more weirdly suggestive, much less left to right.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, reading this again and thinking about the immediate subject of my book and how that subject seems to have a double sense here of being both the what the book is about, but also Proust becoming the investing himself as being in for what the book is about, becoming it in that sense that sort of Keats gives to Shakespeare, the ultimate expression of his creative power, negative capability. I became the subject of my book. I was in for it, in with it.
It's also, he seems to be describing a state I know really well, which is when I'm just about to fall asleep. Not even if I'm not reading, it's an Amtrak feeling somehow. I don't know why, or maybe it's a subway. It's a feeling when you don't expect to be really sleeping, but the train starts and all of a sudden it's the rapturous sucking begins and you're entranced I like to hang out. I always think that it's connected to what Jung called active imagination, when you remain the navigator of your dream because you're half awake. And I start to dream a little bit, but I don't let myself go all the way into the sleep, and I make they're just, I make very strange connections and I correspondences and synchronicities, and it's a kind of like DJing or something with the unconscious, because it's, and obviously I must tip into sleep sometime, but there is a, and it's at moments it's possible to feel enormous abjection and grandiosity at the same time. It's usually what I do. I take a feeling of being utterly bottomed out and eviscerated, and then I try to, I go kind of body surf on the abject feeling, and I go up to a really grandiose feeling. But it's a funny kind of driving of the emotions that is, I feel like what he's talking about in the whole book, but certainly for the first few pages, under the guise of talking about his relationship to reading and his own book.
Yeah. You know, I think John Ashbery, there's a moment in Ashbery that has something of that character.
Yeah. He's always floating in that, yeah.
Yeah, and let's see if we can read it here.
Just for variety, I'm going to go downstairs.
Okay, I may come and join you.
In a minute. Then nobody can see us, but it still could be fun to have you in my bed there.
But I've got a theory too. But I want to.
Okay, I want to hear the theory.
Yeah. So, the picture is almost finished. The surprise almost over, as when one looks out, startled by a snowfall, which even now is ending in specks and sparkles of snow. It happened while you were inside, asleep, and there is no reason why you should have been awake for it, except that the day is ending, and it will be hard for you to get to sleep tonight, at least until late.
So what's your theory?
Well, so that this feels like the sleep that's kind of the waste of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's another thing that poetry and sleep risk having in common, is that they're both wastes of time, even shameful wastes of time, right?
Right.
And here, I was thinking about, in relation to, you know, your sense of surfing out of a kind of abjection, maybe even into grandiosity, on the sort of kind of waves of this middle state. And it feels to me like Ashbery loves, as you said, he loves that, you know, these kind of self-qualifying sentences. It happened while you were inside asleep, and there's no reason why you should have been awake for it, except that the day is ending, at least until late. And then he sort of surfs around, qualifying himself, keeping in those middle moods that are his poetic territory. And that this, you know, he's sort of using this half-conscious state to stay there. Let me go, okay.
Because there's some noise when I go downstairs, there starts
I think
to be
that's,
a noise.
I think that's me
that's
rubbing
you?
It against my comforter.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's fun being up here anyway.
But here's my theory. Here's my theory. That there's something about what you describe and how you're making all sorts of weird connections, this Amtrak experience, that has some relation to aesthetic experience itself. And I'm thinking of Kant here. Mm-hmm. And his sense, whom I also read in the bath. and his sense that what characterizes aesthetic experience is the sort of failure of concepts to adequately compass what's at hand, what's before mm-hmm. us. And that there's this free play of imagination and understanding that is sort of continuous, rather than the concept locking on and are therefore understanding. There's this sort of ongoing undulation, agitation, which is aesthetic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so is there something, you know, is there something of that quality to crepuscular experience?
Mm-hmm.
And is there therefore something constitutively aesthetic about mm-hmm. half sleep?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It's great. I don't. I was just thinking about, in slant relation to that, John Ashbery describing in an interview long ago, I think, his process as dipping, that poetry is always going on, and he just sometimes, or often, he dips the bucket down and he picks some of it up, but that it's. Everything is really. Everything. So all his poems are. Kind of like the way Warhol gave a string of Elvises to a dealer in LA in the early 60s and said, you divide them up into paintings yourself. It doesn't matter how they're, you know, that there is this crepuscular consciousness for Ashbery that's always going on, and he just, so I guess my question is, what is that like? What is it like to be in relation to that kind of a pond of linguistic and cultural La Brea tar pits? So it comes to mind, you know. I don't know. One assumes that it's not aesthetic experience until he's put his bucket down and brought it onto the page. But there's also this, at least the illusion that he's not doing very much to it, well to page.
Right.
It's also, I guess, it's not clear how you're describing aesthetic experience, for whom, who is having that experience? I mean, does the reader of an Ashbery poem have that experience? Only imagining being Ashbery in that state? Isn't there always like the reader, when reading an Ashbery poem, there's several ideal readers floating up. There's like Ashbery and what he really experienced, and then there's a really good reader of Ashbery who understands it, and then there's the reader diving for personal minutiae, and you know.
Yeah, that's a great question. My kind of coming to grips.
Wow.
Is that the Frankfurt School?
I remember going to hear Ashbery read for the first time and having the sense that he was absolutely as puzzled by what was on the page as any of us were. Yeah. And it was like, I don't have to understand this the way I thought I had to understand it. And so I would think that Ashbery would be of a class of poets for whom the experience of writing and the experience of good reading are pretty similar. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whereas there are poets, like maybe Milton is at the other extreme, where you feel like this guy has been out there laying traps all day, and then you waltz mm-hmm. in, and the experience of waltzing in unknowing is so different from what it must have been like to make the thing. And that's an interesting, if you could make a spectrum out of that, you know, where different poets fit in terms of the relationship between the composition and encounter.
So here's like a theorem that occurs to me, or an axiom, that no poet wants his or her reader to be that awake. No poet wants his or her reader to be asleep either, and that there's the drama of the poem seems to be some kind of act of pretending to awaken the reader by giving this privileged information, and and we know it's privileged information because of how carefully and musically or whatever the words are chosen, but that the effect of the words is to somehow glaze over consciousness and to permit a nice anesthesia on the reader's part. And then the reader must struggle to kick that habit and try to stay awake to pay attention to the poem, but then there's the undertow. It's like different, like in a novel, the same thing happens, except it's identification and submersion and suspense that create the anesthesia, but that there's a definite, it's not a soporific effect of poetry, but it's your senses are being teased, and even like in an Emily Dickinson poem, which can't put you to sleep, it's too short. We could get Emily Dickinson on the board there. It's exacting your wakefulness at the same time as the act of that exaction is creating a glaze or a veil.
Yeah, wow. Maybe that's a theory of a rhythm and line, or mm-hmm. meter and line, mm-hmm. or the way in which meter inevitably gets expressed as rhythm divided up by lines. That is, you've got, poetry is going to give you that time of year thou mayst and me behold, when yellow mm-hmm. leaves are none of you do hang. But there's got to be a line break, or you're just going to sail straight across the page, across the room, and off to sleep. So that it has to have, it has both this sort of attention loosening, lullabying, beguiling power, but also periodically, like, the lines end. Dickinson is, you know, her kind of screwing with the ballad stanza,
yeah.
The stanza of the lullaby, right, feels like a...
Are we being told that the conversation is over or that there's no Dickinson? That's okay. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. Sleep is supposed to be... This is a pretty demure poem. This feels like 1859 or something. I mean, it doesn't. Maybe I'm wrong.
I suspect.
But it's regularly punctuated and it's in tercets. Sleep is supposed to be by souls of sanity, the shutting of the eye. Sleep is the station grand down which, on either hand, the hosts of witness stand. Morn is supposed to be, by people of degree, the breaking of the day. Morning has not occurred. That shall aurora be, east of eternity. One with a banner gay, one in the red array. That is the break of day. She's clever, but one with the banner gay and one in the red array seems to me absolutely an instance of deliberate hypnosis of the that there's no real syntax there. I mean, it's not a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is one with a banner gay going to be doing something? Is that one the subject of the sentence, or is it just that she's pointing them out? One with a banner gay, one. And is it two different ones? But there's a moment of paralysis and arrest there that is. Corresponds to glazed consciousness.
Interesting, or some glaze, and also if you can combine these things, and maybe at the end you can apocalypse.
Yeah,
you know, that's the
she's witnessing.
This is one of these poems that feels like it's about how we are asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we're all asleep, and we've never not been asleep, but we are someday going to wake.
Yeah. Wow. Does that mean that the audience is going to fall asleep if we don't let them ask questions? I think it does. So I think it's time to have the audience ask questions.
So I have a microphone here. And if you'd all be so kind as to ask whatever questions you have in a whisper to our...
Because we got to go to sleep.
...talkers, because they've been working hard. If anybody has any questions... let me know.
This isn't so much a question as a kind of an observation that the Ashbery poem that we talked about started in by referring to the picture being almost over, I think. And I hope that Ashbery meant the movie that they were watching, but I'm just curious to know if that's how you read it, and also what the relationship is between the cinematic and the sleepy.
Hmm. Well, that's really, I'll just say that a poem is more like a still, induces the state of a still photograph, which is arrest, and that a film induces a kind of, it's like a different kind of distracted experience, possibly, than... But I don't know. I think Ashbery probably meant like the Parmigianino picture, because it's from Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror. But I bet he also meant picture. Moving picture. And he should have if he didn't.
Yeah, it would. It might just be sort of on that borderline that we were talking between making and receiving, and maybe sleep has something of that character too, because the authorship at that crepuscular moment is a weird question, right? Because it ain't anybody else who's doing it, but it's not you who's doing it exactly. Whose movie are you watching? Who's making this picture?
I realized I forgot to sleepwalk. I used to sleepwalk when I was a kid. Exactly situations like this, I think. Big groups. I would sleepwalk. I went sleepwalk into somebody else's sleeping bag in a large campsite. So I wanted to do a little sleepwalking. Another question?
Is that a question?
Who chose these images?
They
come from our collective dream space. So.
But that is, look at that tape recorder. That is amazing. No little kid has a tape recorder that big.
Wayne, when you were talking about that in-between period between sleep and wake, have you always navigated that easefully, or I think it's often termed as night terrors or sleep paralysis, where sort of negativity arises. But has that been the case for you ever, or something you've just always been graceful with?
The Elizabeth Bishop poem with which we started, Sleeping on the Ceiling, just feels like it's so much about that problem. I sort of come back to that idea. It's linked with these problems of, you know, authorship and poetry and sleep and what you receive and what you make. And it's linked with questions of shame, I think, and that sense that, you know, you let go and your mind goes in these awful directions, or finds itself with net and trident pursuing these gladiator ants. So that, you know, that seems to capture the risk of that interval for me, and that the risk that might, among other things, that might wake you up, right?
And I was thinking of an analogous state. First, there's the Amtrak surfing of abjection and grandiosity and building a little archive of synchronicities from my past and from present as well. But there's also the state waking up really in the morning, a real waking up, where I like to lie in bed for maybe a half an hour and feel suffused with intense anxiety about everything that's going to happen in that day. But that I also have an active relationship to it, a kind of playing it, spinning it, where my remoteness from the real events of the day that are so terrifying makes them imaginary. So the longer they get, more and more frightening the longer I stay in bed, but I also grow more and more immune, and I can fall back asleep and transmute them and go back to a dream. And it's you know, it's a kind of really great game state.
Other questions?
The guy with the plaid shirt.
Yes, I see him.
So do you guys have any thoughts on poetry and insomnia? It's the title of another Elizabeth Bishop poem. I remember a story. Someone told me that James Merrill used to not be able to sleep a lot of nights, and he just lay like a vampire, sort of with his arms crossed, and he would fall asleep.
Elaine Equi, who's a really wonderful contemporary poet living in New York, has written about insomnia, and I think maybe she still is, but for years had really dire insomnia, and we used to have a lot of conversations about it, and it seemed akin to her poetics of always finding making everything strange through alert juxtapositions. So there was a kind of alertness, a constant wakefulness. The world was always nervy and on edge for her, it seemed, in her poems, and that I connected to her insomnia.
I've never been an insomniac. I'm all too ready to fall asleep almost always. But I do. when we were talking about this, I got to thinking about the various postures of sleeping. To lie like a vampire, for example, with your arms crossed across your chest. Wayne asked me, because he knows that I'm preoccupied with questions of style, are there styles of sleep? And it feels like a sort of boundary challenging question, in the sense that style seems like such a sort of willed and sociable phenomenon, and such a matter of choice. If you have options, you choose what style to cultivate or adopt. But you can leave yourself in different postures. You could leave yourself here. You could leave yourself, you know, in something like that. You could even, and it's a question of whether it would be a style or not. Well, you could leave yourself like this. Bankers might wish to sleep like this, or at least, you know,
It's like a death scene, right? How do I position myself for that? You don't have so much control about what happens afterward, but hopefully you can get through the night in this posture of moneyed self-satisfaction. Hmm. Or you can curl up in a ball. And that might be a style, and it might not.
Well, apropos of that, I just wanted to mention babies, when you stop swaddling them, go into an instinctive fencing posture when they sleep.
Like what?
It's sort of like
on guard.
And it's always an amazement because, you know, you've been swaddling them and then suddenly someone says, well, it's time to stop swaddling them, and they go into this strange, elegant little posture. Huh. But what I wanted to ask was about Whitman, since we're in Brooklyn. Sleep as democracy. You know, we've been talking about the subject, sleeping, but the idea that you visit all the sleepers, sleep is the great equalizer, the next best equalizer to death, something like
that's
that.
That's great. Yeah, sleep and solidarity,
I can't come up with anyone else who's doing that.
You know, it feels like that touches the, you know, I was thinking also about phrases like to sleep with someone or to sleep together. And the sort of wonderfulness and strangeness of that, sleeping together. Because when you're sleeping, sleep seems to sort of radicalize the worry that everybody's actually in here, right?
Right.
It's like, you're in here. I go to sleep and it's manifestly true.
Right.
And boy, would I like not, you know, I'd like to sleep with someone so I don't...
So you're not stuck.
I'm not stuck, yeah.
Also, in terms of the democracy in sleep, I've always been haunted by the late Susan Sontag's claim that she didn't sleep very much, didn't need very much sleep, and that there was somehow a relation for her, and she seemed to be advocating this between avidity for cultural and aesthetic experience, or for living life intensely, and being insomniac, or just not needing sleep. And as somebody who, as I've revealed, spends a lot of time in various twilight states and aims to spend more time in them, you know, I've always felt a kind of shame or sense of failure that, it's really, really clear to me that I would rather be napping than going to the ballet.
Yeah. One other thought about that. For a host of reasons, recently I was sort of unusually and radically without sleep, and I was on the subway and nearly nodded off. And it made me think about the... in a sense, the opposite of that. That is, there's the promise of the democracy of sleep. Everyone sleeps together. It synchronizes us. We sleep at the same time. Mm. But of course, some people really get to sleep more than others.
Yeah.
You can have two jobs or three jobs, and then you don't sleep much, and you ride the subway early in the morning or late at night to one of those jobs. You're tired.
There was a lady who lived in my neighborhood who was a day sleeper. There probably were a lot of day sleepers, but she had a sign on her door saying, you know, something like, warning, day sleeper, do not disturb. I thought she was a witch.
A
day sleeper.
A day sleeper. See, that reminds me of a phrase of Maureen's that I keep coming back to. It's like, what would it be like to live in a post-shame society? Huh. And I think one answer would be putting a sign on your door that says,
day sleeper. Another? Yeah, I guess it might be. I guess I would just speak to what you were talking about with Susan Sontag. And as a, by way of antidote, I remember reading Jane Eyre for the first time when I was in middle school, not understanding what I was reading, but falling asleep after about, chapter 5, and dreaming the rest of the narrative. And I realized that became sort of a reading habit of mine.
So I'm really kind of concerned about what I actually read or not. Mm-hmm. So I remember my orals was very anxious for me because I thought I would just start making stuff up, that I would be like, oh, and then, you know, after the death. No one dies in that. What are you talking about? Right. But this idea of sleep reading versus sleep walking, of if Susan Sontag is providing a kind of insomniac, almost paranoid alertness to all aesthetic activity, there might be a more depressive mode to reading of... in which a space to be lazy, a space to actually sleep read, a completely different aesthetic practice. So it's more of observation than a question.
No, it's just really nifty sleep reading. I've never done it, but you have, and I think that's great.
I think you have, actually.
And that it's a little bit like you can feel the same way about watching someone read and watching someone sleep. That is, something's going on, and it's not being dramatized. You can't join in on it, and it's very still.
Mm-hmm. There's a weird disconnect between the microphone and the hands, because there's all sorts of people with hands raised.
Back to this whole thing with the equalizing, like sleep as equalizer. It's like the whole language around nighttime, like sleep as evening, like the evening leading to sleep. Like that language occurs in like the Inferno at the beginning when he doesn't sleep through this evening time.
Wow. Milton loves that too. Eve and evening is a recurring trope in that poem.
Does leavening get to be included in that on the eve of Passover?
This idea of sleep as democracy is kind of troubling. For me, it's quite the opposite. I mean, it would be saying like shitting as democracy, right? Like we don't talk about it, we do it. We never talk about it. You know, it doesn't even exist. But you know, I sleep a lot, like really a lot. And I always get these phone calls around like, you know, between noon and two when I'm supposed to be awake, and it'll be somebody, you know, who's responsible and awake, and they'll ask me, oh, sorry, were you sleeping? And I say, oh no, you know, I just woke up, you know. Of course, like I just woke up because they called me. So, and then, you know, also, you know, there's all sorts of materials to sleep on. You know, you can sleep with satin sheets, or you can have really high thread count, or you can have. You know, just a mattress or not even a mattress.
So true.
Yeah, I mean, good sheets are really great, and this has nothing to do with the question I wanted to ask, but I just wanted to say that, because sleep is, yeah, shameful. Yeah, totally. I don't know why somebody will call me and say, oh, don't worry, you know, I'm sorry to bother you, and it's like, no, you're not bothering me. You know, but of course they are, you know, I was sleeping. So there's always this thing, I don't know, but my question was...
Can I just interrupt you to say that you should read, and this injunction goes for everyone, always, but you should read The Faerie Queen, with the great 16th century epic poem by Edmund Spenser, which is sort of preoccupied with this dilemma. There are all kinds of characters who make the mistake of falling asleep, poured out in looseness on the grassy ground, and it's always a mistake, and the poem knows it both inhabits the severe judgment that we render on lapses of vigilance, and it also knows that we have to sleep, and sees us as a society as being unable to resolve that problem. Mm-hmm. I commend it to you. But your question.
Well, sleep deprivation is a political issue.
Yeah.
Well, you know, maybe there's a connection between my favorite poet is Jack Spicer, and I'm wondering if there's a connection between this idea of you know, the poet as a radio, you know, sort of receiving, and a certain love for sleep as maybe this kind of like hyperactive state, or not.
I would say yes. I mean, to the if there was an either or, the first part of what you said, that being a radio, whatever you said, yes, I agree with it. I also wanted to say about what you did, your beautiful prelude to your question about the shame of, but also a kind of sleeper's pride that you seem to evince. Just your invocation of the specific voice with which you answer the phone pretending, you know, and your voice reveals, it's sort of like a smoker's voice. I mean, it reveals the sin. Phlegm-laced, thick with mucus, yeah. Immersed in internal process, yeah.
I mean, it's a killer, isn't it? It's like sleep is a sin, and if you've sinned, you can't sleep.
Yeah. And it's a class issue. I mean, that's the, you know, people, you know, if you, it's like that poor day sleeper that I thought of as some exotic, you know, had to work, so.
Well, maybe sort of opposing shame to the sleep shame that I sometimes feel on behalf of others, it's sort of like a horror more, is when I happen to bring up dreams with somebody, and it happens more often, you know, it's very common actually. I talk about my dreams a lot because they're very important to me. And I encounter somebody, you know, who I know or I don't know very well, and I discover that the dreams mean nothing to them, that they have some sort of rationalization of the fact that, you know, they've read some study or whatever it is. That dreams, you know, the dreams mean nothing. They mean what you do the day before. They, you know, they're for purposes of memory, whatever they say. And this, you know, rationalization then basically prevents them ever from having meaningful dreams, in my opinion. And I feel, you know, whenever that situation arises, I feel kind of this really, like, this inner revulsion to that almost very dystopic feeling, mm-hmm. that they've sort of been convinced, you know, that there's no value at all to their sleeping state that they could bring in. I had just a response to the question about the Ashbery portrait. If I recall, that's sort of from near the beginning of the poem, when he's after he's taken his first look at the Parmigianino portrait, and then he sort of describes it, and then he kind of goes back at the portrait, and that's almost when the meat of the poem really begins, if I recall, and he's. At that moment, he's uncovering the process that went into the poem. So the painting. He imagines the portrait in the process of creation. He imagines Parmigianino's hand working at the portrait. And there's something about that accession of this alternate temporality, as that section that you read sort of evinced with the signs, exterior signs of the time passing, that is only accessible to Ashbery because he's in the process of creating as well. There's something about this doorway between the act of creation of the poem and the act of creation of the painting, which enables Ashbery to commune with Parmigianino. But this act of creation being like a sleep state, an alternate temporal state that passes very unnoticeably, natural. The metaphors you use are, I think, the snow, you know, the speckling, the falling. And anyway, that's my comment.
That's great. Just in the first thing you said about how demeaning it is that the cultural treasure of people's dreams is, in some people's minds, dispensed with as merely the day's residue, with no without its phenomenological richness and just its import and beauty. It's just like a kind of cultural creation that we're undergoing collectively and individually every night. And it's great. It is a wrought mosaic.
And I wonder if you could feel that way about your dreams and have any and care about poems. Mm-hmm. I'm getting
okay. I'm really tired.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really tired.
Do you want to...
Where should I sleep? Downstairs.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's...
But do you want to read something before we drift off?
Yeah. I want to say that when you were convening, that we were listening to the sleepwalking scene from Verdi's Macbeth, sung by Maria Callas live in 1952, and it was on loop, so it just kept on, she kept on washing her hands. So, read me something. You have the books up there. You have the books up there.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll...
Oh, maybe we. Oh, maybe we're just going to listen to music as we go to sleep.
Shall I read Insomnia?
Yeah, that's great.
We always read this before bed. Okay. The moon in the bureau mirror looks out a million miles, and perhaps with pride at herself, but she never, never smiles. Far and away beyond sleep, or perhaps she's a daytime sleeper. By the universe deserted, she'd tell it to go to hell, and she'd find a body of water or a mirror on which to dwell. So wrap up care in a cobweb and drop it down the well. Into that world inverted, where left is always right, where the shadows are really the body, where we stay awake all night, where the heavens are shallow as the sea is now deep, and you love me.
Good night.
Good night, Wayne. Sleep well.
Okay, you too.
Thanks.
I woke up.
Now we're never going to get to sleep.